Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Happy New Year. It's 2024 and I'm still Ali Milani and this is still Politics Uncensored and we're still looking back at the best bits from 2023. It's a brand new year and we have an exciting cohort of guests to look forward to in 2024. But before we get to all of those amazing guests and those amazing episodes that we've got lined up for you, let's look back one last time to my favorite interviews from 2023. First, I got a chance to sit down with the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, about his new poetry anthology, Poetry for the Many. We spoke about his early career in politics, being elected leader of the Labour Party in 2015, his opinions on Sir Keir Starmer, and we might have even had a conversation about poems and jams. Do give a listen. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
First of all, how are you?
Very, very well, thank you. As you see me.
Yes. Well, I was going to start this. If it was anyone else, I'd be starting this with, you know, post-leadership years. You must be having a lot of time off and relaxing, but it seems like your schedule is just as busy as it was when you were leader of the party.
I'm shocked at the question, actually. Yeah. No, my whole life has always been very occupied and very busy, and now is no different to any other time.
Yeah, and so you're still at the front line fighting good fights.
Obviously, the MP for my area, and that takes up a lot of time anyway. Doing a lot of stuff in Parliament, a lot of campaigning work, and building up the Peace and Justice Project, which is going extremely well. Mm. And working on a book I'm writing myself, which is going well.
Yeah,
we're nearly at the final editing stage. And this book we've just produced, Poetry.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about the poetry book. I actually didn't know that you were writing another book. Is that a memoir or...?
It's no, not exactly. It started out as an analysis of the 5 years of leadership of the Labour Party. But somebody pointed out to me you couldn't really talk about that without putting it in the context of the political events that went before and of your own life.
Mm-hmm.
And so... I then started writing a chapter about my own political activities. And after this chapter got into the several tens of thousands of words, somebody suggested you'd make it into several chapters.
You should probably then, once you're in the tens of thousands of words. Yeah.
I don't really think most chapters should go beyond about 5,000 words. Anyway, the book is going extremely well, fascinating to do. And it will give, if you like, a balanced, I hope, view of a lot of things and my side of the story.
Yeah, so I do kind of want to look back a little bit and then look as a result look forward, because I think you have one of the most interesting stories in British political world, certainly of my lifetime. And so I want to kind of look back at your time as an MP, as leader of the party, and then that's probably informed the book that you've written, but also the themes of the poetry book, which we're going to talk about as well, which was brilliant and I read. Can you give me a little bit of your sense of your history in Islington North? I know how important your constituency is to you. I think that's one of the key things, even throughout your leadership years, and from everybody that I speak to in your area, because I'm not that far from it. Mm. How did the story in Islington North start for you? Councillor, activist?
I didn't set out in life to become a Member of Parliament. That wasn't my sort of life's ambition. I was obviously active in the Labour Party. I was a councillor. I was a union organiser. And I'd done lots and lots of jobs. Then when the previous MP for Islington North, a gentleman called Michael O'Halloran, was left the Labour Party and joined the SDP, and then... the party then had to select a candidate. A group of comrades approached me and said, would you put my name forward? I thought about it, said, all right. And then we had the longest selection process ever. We had 6 months.
6 months selection process?
Yes. Selection started in September 81. At the time, Tony Benn was challenging for deputy leadership of the party, and I was obviously very involved in his campaign, and it finished in March 82.
It's like a Premier League season.
Absolutely.
Why was it so long?
Well, they wanted to make sure everybody had a say, and everybody duly did have
a say. Was there a lot of candidates?
Yeah, there were a lot of candidates, and eventually... It was done by a general management committee delegate voting. And eventually I got it by 39 votes to 35 on the sixth ballot.
On the sixth. Did you think you were going to win when you put your name forward?
No.
No.
No, you can't go into something like that assuming you're going to win. If you do, you certainly lose.
Yeah.
No, I said, look, I just said, look, this is me. Here I am. This is what I think about.
Yeah. Because when I did it in Uxbridge under your leadership, yeah. The way I was convinced to do it was, you run and just put the ideas on the table, and then the eventual winner will take it on. Similar, I think, to your leadership bids, and it was the same for you. Then you were just putting the ideas.
So
forward.
I put the ideas. Then talked. I was a councillor in the neighbouring borough, so I obviously had some knowledge of, well, quite a lot of knowledge of the area, and mm-hmm. I found it interesting doing these discussions and debates. And the number of points that I brought out from it was that the MP has to be rooted in the community. They have to be involved in the community and they have to try and represent it. But above all, they mustn't never go away from the community, mm-hmm. which is why during all of the time, my office, the only time I ever get irritated with my office is if they take time away from the constituency. Mm-hmm. And when I was leader of the party, we had this golden rule that at least one full day a week would be in Islington North. And they said, can't do that. So I said, no, I'm sorry. Yeah. This is a rule that will not.
But you know, it's
this is a rule that will not be broken.
It's not. I think that the reason that that's important, it's not just that, you know, it allows you to stay connected to the community from an electoral perspective, but it keeps your ear to the ground. You get to hear from real people, right?
Also, people I've known for a very long time.
Yeah,
and these are, you know, people in different communities, jobs, industries, businesses, all that. Yeah. I know them all very, very well. Yeah. And they will tell me what they think. And I trust their opinions.
And that difference is really interesting. I remember, and again, just one of my personal stories, I did one of the Sunday programs. Yeah. When my campaign kicked off, I went on the Sunday program and I bombed. I was terrible, right? Mm-hmm. And I had a canvassing session straight after. And I drove back and I was in sweats. I thought I'd ruin everything. I thought I'd screwed you up and you're gonna get shit because of my performance. And then I started knocking on doors and realized, no one watched it, right? They had far too much in their own lives going on, from like feeding the kids and affording uniforms and things like that, to pay attention to Westminster.
Yeah.
So I wonder, you know, you've had such a long and you've been through different eras in British politics. That Westminster bubble, you got to tell me what that's like when you...
Well,
because it's not real life.
It's kind of unreal. I remember very early on, I'd been elected about couple of months or so this would have been summer 83. I went to a meeting of a tenants association in July, and the association meeting started about 7:30, and it went on a bit and so on. It came towards 9 o'clock, and I said to the chair, look, I'm really sorry, I'm gonna have to go now. Why? I said, well, I've got to go to Parliament because there's a very important vote at 10 o'clock and I think I should be there taking part in that vote. So I really have to go now because I've got to get there. Is that all right? I said, no. I said, well, this is a bit difficult, but I understand you've got some issues you still want to discuss, but we've already been here 2 hours. Mm-hmm. I said, And this woman said, Jeremy, listen, I met you just before the election. And you told me you're going to be for round here. I didn't realise you were also going to get mixed up with Westminster.
What did you think you were doing? Right.
So she said, well, this time is all right, but, you know, just think. I just realised that, I mean, it was partly said in joke and jest, but also there is a point that is very easy to become totally absorbed with the minutiae of Westminster.
Yeah.
And if you enjoy that kind of thing, it can be fascinating. Well, you love gossip. But actually, it's an unreality.
But the problem with it is they're so disconnected. Yeah. And like, I'll give you an example. I won't mention who because it's unfair. But I spoke to the senior advisor to one of the shadow ministers, front benchers, about the situation going on in Gaza. And I said, you know, do they know the amount of emails and outrage within the communities? And the advisor told me, no, because we're not showing them the emails. We're keeping it from them, right? So to kind of protect them from the stress and outrage of what's going on. And that led me to think, hang on, this person presumably spends most of their time in Westminster, right? So isn't actually interacting a whole lot with the community. And then they're not even seeing the emails. So it's so easy to then just get caught in that bubble, isn't it? To just think that that's what everyone else is thinking. The tea rooms of the House of Commons is what everyone else is thinking. And that's where the divide in politics comes.
The point you were making about your canvassing session after the interview, in reality, I'm in Parliament some days and there's like most massive furore about some process or other. Everybody's yakking all the time. And then
the rest of the country doesn't care.
And outside people,
yeah. So what? The bit that they care about is when they go to pay their energy bill, for example, and can't afford it.
Or
right?
Can't get a house.
Or can't get a house, yeah. So, I mean, look, you did go to Westminster in the end, and you spent quite a lot of time campaigning on the issues that you were really passionate about. But eventually, we get to the 2015 leadership election. And we've had John McDonnell on here, kind of talked us through how that went and the beginning processes and from his perspective, what it was like. Mm. What I'd love to hear from you is, look, again, kind of like when you ran for MP, you didn't think you were going to win that leadership, did you?
Well, no, we put my name forward because I was very determined that we put up a challenge. I have to say, many of my colleagues, close colleagues in the Socialist Campaign Group said it's a waste of time, there's no point in doing it.
Yeah.
We even had a meeting of various left groups in Camden one night. It was probably organised by a Labour Representation Committee and a whole lot of groups there. And they sort of, oh, no, it's a waste of time, we'll never get it.
Won't even get on the ballot.
What's the point? We should concentrate on doing policy. And I got quite annoyed. I said, look, guys, if you miss this opportunity to stake your claim to a different form of politics, to stand up against the austerity economics and all this, then forget it on policy in the future because you've lost the chance to raise it at the time when party members are most engaged. And they didn't really agree with me.
Yeah.
And this was like about 2 weeks before the whole thing kicked off. I then went away to the USA for a week. On Guantanamo Bay, we were lobbying the Senate and the House. And I went to New York for the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So I was away for about a week. And I came back, and they're still having the same discussion. And I said, look, if you don't put up, you can't complain. It's not about me, it's about whoever you decide to put up. So eventually we get to a meeting of the campaign group of MPs, which wasn't very big. And they go around the table and say, well, okay, I made the same speech, said somebody's got to do it. So they all said, okay, John, Mac, you do it. You did it last time. He said, no, nope, done all that. I'm not doing that again. Okay. So we then get to look around at Diane.
Abbott, yeah, she'd done it before.
She said, I've done that before. I'm not doing it again, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
She said, which is a good endorsement for you.
She said, it's hell doing it. And so there was then a silence, and I bent over and wrote some of my notebook because I kind of inveterate note taker. And I look up and they're all pointed at me.
You realize you're the last man left in the room.
I said, what's the matter with you guys? They said, well, since you're the one who talked us into this, you better do it.
Mm.
So, all right. And at that point, Diane's hand shot across the table and she pressed something. I said, what was that? Sort of just sending out a tweet saying you're running.
Oh, Christ. So really nailing you to that decision.
No escape from that point onwards.
Yeah. And
we had no organisation. We had no money. We didn't have anything. We just had my credit card and that didn't last.
Yeah.
then we just went out there and said, okay, this is to direct the party away from austerity economics into a different form of politics. We had the Nuneaton debate almost straight away. That was Newsnight, early evening Nuneaton debate with the other candidates. And things began to change very quickly.
At what point did you realize we might win this thing? Was there a moment where you were like...
Yeah, there was. To begin with, I remember talking privately to John and others. I said, well, how do you think we can do? And they were sort of saying... 20-25%. And I said, it might be better than that, maybe 30.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it began to change was that we'd done a lot of these, we'd started doing the regional hustings and they'd gone very well. And we organized a public meeting straight after the East Midlands hustings in Nottingham at the Arts Centre. And it was absolutely rampacked. half an hour before it was due to begin. And so I thought, sign of something.
Yeah.
And then we the hustings got bigger and bigger, and
you were running
beginning to grow.
You were running a kind of different campaign, I remember, because traditionally, I think what the leadership campaigns, they do lots of media and they do the hustings,
yeah.
But you did a lot of community-based events, right? You pack out rooms and speak directly to the members.
I did public meetings all over the place. There was never a restriction on attendance.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of open-air rallies as well because it was summertime. Yeah. It was easier to do that. And so that changed the atmosphere. When it fundamentally changed was we were in South Wales doing events then. I'd done South Wales, I'd done Welsh Radio that morning, Sunday morning. And then I was going back to the station in Cardiff and I got a call from Unite to say the Unite executive is now nominating you.
Right.
And that was,
yeah. That was big,
a
yeah.
Very important moment because mm-hmm. Unite were then formally backing me. Other unions already said they would, like ASLEF yeah. and so on, but Unite came on board at that stage. I was still not convinced we were going to win. I was the last person to be convinced we had a chance of winning,
right,
and that
yeah.
was in probably the middle of August. But what I said was, don't imagine we're going to win. The campaign has got to go on.
Yeah.
And we had all these phone banking sessions. We probably had the biggest phone bank ever. I think we had 600 people on a phone yeah. bank one day, that sort of thing. So we did a big campaign and mobilized a lot of people.
Yeah.
But you know the result. It was amazing.
So I've always been curious about this. You win the election.
Mm.
That night, you go home, put the key in the door, open, mm. sit on the couch. Mm. What are you feeling?
Well, we went first of all to Troya restaurant at South Bank, and John was there and a lot of other people. I wanted just to say thank you to the team for everything they'd done. And then I got home and thought, oh, wow. And then the next day, there was the first of...
But what are you feeling when you're at home? Is there a little bit of fear? Is there a little bit of proud?
Proud of the achievement we had made. Very humble to have had this thing, this yeah. trust placed
upon me. Because
it
wasn't a small margin of victory either. It was quite a big margin of victory.
It was overwhelming, yeah. And then I was just sort of starting to think of all the issues we're going to face and all the problems we would get and the difficulties, but also the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity to develop our political system in a much more open way and open up particularly for marginalized communities. Fundamentally, it's one for everybody.
Yeah.
Then the next argument was about the following morning, because I was told by the Labour Party head office that the tradition was the newly elected leader went to do Andrew Marr the next morning.
All right.
And I said, well, so what? And they said, well, you've got to do it. I said, no, I've already booked to do a mental health day event with the Camden Islington mental health group and to talk about mental health.
Yeah.
So I'll do that.
And immediately after, you went to the refugee event. Yeah.
Immediately after I was elected, I said, well, I'm going to start as I'm going to go on. I'm going to speak at the Refugees Are Welcome rally in Parliament Square, which I did.
Yeah.
I have to say, a lot of my team didn't want me to do that because they said it's difficult security-wise and crowds and things. But you know,
have you ever been concerned about?
I'm going to do it.
Have you ever been concerned about your security?
Not really. No. I mean, you can't go around always being worried about your own security, because if you do, you end up never going anywhere.
But I imagine your family have always been concerned about that, right?
My loved ones and family, and my wife Lara, and my sons are continually worried about this. And we have had...
I can imagine,
we've had some very unpleasant incidents.
But not, I think... But
you know, 90% of it is the opposite.
No, I imagine 90% of it will be positive, right? And
what are those... The safest place I feel is Islington
North. Right. Yeah. So I want to kind of look back on your leadership years. I totally reject this idea that because we didn't win in 2019, that nothing was achieved in the 5 years of leadership. And I'll give you a few examples as to what I think, even if you think away from policy. I mean, there were lots of things that you got the government to U-turn on. I also think it's worth bearing in mind, a lot of people don't know that during COVID, the scheme where people got paid, it's gone out of my head now, the name of it, was actually a policy idea that came from us.
That's fair. Thank you. That's absolutely right. We achieved some significant policy changes. We opened up a whole debate about austerity economics and so on, and the idea that austerity economics has got to lower living standards rather than redistribute power and wealth. And actually, the Financial Times conceded that. They said, thanks to the efforts of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn to challenge austerity economics, things have changed. It's no longer that easy
agenda. That's so important, because I think I remember when Ed was leader and we gave up the space, and I'm not having a go at Ed, but I think the whole party did this. We gave up the austerity space. Because we weren't anti-austerity, we moved the norm in our political space where it became almost impossible for people to argue against austerity.
The 2015 election, both parties were committed to a wage freeze in the public sector.
Look, I think if we'd adopted an anti-austerity position, we would have won that 2015 election. And if, honestly, I think Ed would admit that in his heart as well. And one of the things that's interesting, my perspective, and it is just entirely my perspective, I think once Ed saw your leadership, he felt like maybe he was a little bit too chained to the status quo when he was leader, and he wished he could have gone further. But I want you to look back. So the 5 years, what are some of the proudest achievements?
Proudest issues, Iraq war apology.
Yeah.
Green New Deal policies, getting Parliament to agree on a climate emergency being declared by Britain, the public ownership debate, which is now everybody's in favour of public ownership of rail, mail, water and energy, being prepared to stand up to issues on foreign policy where we don't go in militarily, instead we go in with an agenda for peace and for change. But above all, of mobilising an awful lot of people to become involved in politics. I've just come from SOAS. I was doing a reading of law about conflict war, you know, rules of war, reading them out. Hundreds and hundreds of students there. So many of them said, I only got involved in politics during your time as leader.
And so on that, on the mobilisation, I want to show you something. Can we throw... So for those who aren't watching, we're watching you at Glastonbury giving the speech in front of what looks like to me like hundreds of thousands of people. Headphones on, but I'll play this now for you.
Is it on these headphones?
Yeah. You want to put that up? What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary.
That is unprecedented in British politics. We're not, our politics just isn't like that, right? It's not America where you get these massive rallies where thousands of people show up. But here, you've got hundreds of thousands of people who, most of them, let's be honest, wouldn't have had politics as one of their top issues that they're interested in their life, even though we know politics affects all of us. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn."
It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. We wrote, the office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury with me.
I'm sure they did.
Every single one said it's really necessary for me to come.
Jeremy, just for your security, I have to come.
So we spent a lot of time in discussion with Michael Eavis about how many tickets we could have. He was very generous, to be fair.
But did you think at that point, I could win a general election?
Well, I thought, my God, we've got this, having not won a general election, which is one of the reasons I pushed really hard for an early poll. It was really exciting to do. But you know what? 6 months later, maybe less than 6 months later, I was at Glastonbury again, because Michael invited me to go there to open the social housing units that he'd built with the profits of Glastonbury. Well done him. So I went to open them and meet the new tenants and residents. And then we went to the field. It was empty. The pyramid stage had gone, except for like the skeleton of it. And the sheep were there. So I stood there in the middle of the field amongst the sheep, looking at the stage.
Which, knowing you as well, you love nature, so why not?
And you could see Glastonbury tour. And I remember being taken to Glastonbury tour as a kid by my mum and dad. Because we lived in Wiltshire.
And so, obviously at that point, I think you think, we got a chance, at least, at a general election. This mobilisation, I think, is really, really important. Because often I think our politics is obsessed with the Westminster game. But one of the things that your leadership did, certainly, without a Jeremy Corbyn leadership, and I don't want to focus on you just as an individual. Obviously, you were the leadership, but you were the leader of a movement, right? Without Jeremy Corbyn, I don't think Zara Sultana MP happens. I don't think for example, Apsana Begum happens. Mm. There are so many journalists that I know that kind of got inspired into politics that have gone into journalism. And for sure, I can tell you for sure, Ali Milani isn't sat in the studio interviewing now. Is that something that you can look on proudly to say, look, this, I inspired these people to get into politics?
I look very proudly on the way we managed to excite and mobilize so many people. What I always felt was that we were a distance away from the movement we'd created. Mm-hmm. And I wrote in my diary the weekend I was elected, and I'd spent the whole weekend in arguments with people in the Parliamentary Labour Party about appointments and so on, and sort of realised the problems that was going to be thrown at me. And I felt we're in danger of being so high up the beach, we're too far away from the crowd at the south, at the bottom of it. And all the time, my leadership, there was this problem of the traditions, attitudes of the bureaucracy of the Labour Party, which were pretty hostile to me, gave me a lot of trouble. And the Parliamentary Labour Party, which was very hostile to me from the very beginning. And it was only after the 2017 election, that was 2 years later, things became a bit better because more people have been elected as Labour MPs that were sympathetic.
I want to ask you this, and we'll move on this. Regrets. Looking back, I mean, it's so easy in hindsight to look back and go, I would have done this, this, and this
differently. We underestimated the opposition within the Labour Party. I had a belief that all those that worked for the Labour Party would support what we were trying to do. They didn't. They undermined and they tried to weaken it. And dealing with the mainstream media is never easy. We underestimated the malevolence and the hostility of right-wing press in Britain.
I mean, at one point, the Daily Mail ran like a 15-page spread or something.
Daily Mail, the Daily Express, all of them ran terrible stuff on me day in, day out, and my house was under siege.
What was
sometimes
that like?
Lara couldn't go out at all.
What was that like?
Horrible.
Yeah.
Because you wake up in the morning. Most people wake up on a summer's morning hoping to hear a dawn chorus. What do I hear?
Yeah.
Chattering photographers outside. You then jostle, and harass. Yeah.
But also, like, you mentioned your wife. Your family often, and I know this because I got maybe 0.5% of it when I ran against Boris. Your family end up paying the price for it, don't they?
Absolutely. And it meant that Lara, who is very political, very active, very knowledgeable, got either belittled or abused or attacked and so on. And she's actually a very significant person in her own right, nothing to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a Mexican woman, very interested in Mexico and so on. And obviously she got a lot of attacks, as did my sons.
Yeah. And everyone, I think people forget often. I think the media forget.
Them, I mean, in a sense, I can take it because it's me. I chose to do this. They didn't, and the horrors they got. The other thing is, one should be very careful of the insidious language that's used by the media you think you're friends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I completely wrongly assumed that liberal papers, so-called, like The Guardian, would be, I'm not asking for endorsement, not asking for support, at least give us a fair hearing. They didn't.
You didn't feel like they gave you a fair hearing? No. Did anyone give you a fair hearing?
Well, and academic analysis show that only 90% of the media reporting was hostile.
Only that. You got 10%.
Well, no, some of them are neutral.
All right, I'm going to ask you this question. Be honest with me, okay?
Of course.
Looking back, I put you in a time machine, take you back to that room where John said, I'm not doing it. Diane said, I'm not doing it. And you make that decision again. Would you run again?
Yes.
100%.
100%.
You said that without even...
Without a blink, without a delay, without hesitation. This is like just a minute, isn't it?
Yeah, I like it. Well, that tells me exactly where you are. And so I have to ask you a little bit about Keir. I hope you don't mind. Because he served in your shadow cabinet. What was it like with him at the time? Did you have a relationship with him?
We appointed him as a shadow Brexit secretary after the referendum. I knew what his views were on Brexit, obviously. And I felt that we were going to navigate a difficult path. And I also appointed people to join in the negotiating team with the government who had an opposite point of view to him. John Trickett and Rebecca Long-Bailey, for example. how should I put it? I never felt very close to Keir. He was efficient at analysing the legislation and very quick at that. But was he particularly involved in everything else in every other political discussion? No. Didn't show much interest in all the other issues we're dealing with. Never spoke when we're discussing housing, environment, or anything else. That was it. Was he close? No.
Did you feel like you know, he just had an interest in his own brief and nothing else?
Well, I asked him to do that brief. We went to Brussels together a couple of times, and we had lengthy discussions with Michel Barnier. I felt that we were in quite a good place when I proposed a customs union as a way forward, a sort of a leave EU, have customs union alternative, which would have meant you'd basically there wouldn't be the disruption of trade. He apparently went along with that and supported that, and indeed was there at the Coventry speech when I proposed that.
Yeah.
But
do you regret?
He's a very different person now than he was then.
Oh, really? Okay. So it's very, very different now. Yeah. Even on a personal level, I assume you guys don't talk now.
Well, he hasn't spoken to me for 2 years.
Or yeah. I have a question just on that Brexit policy. Do you regret the position we ended up with in 2019? Because I tell you what, I supported it. I thought it was the right move at the time. I now think, you know, I was wrong at the time.
Well,
I think we should have stuck to our guns.
Complicated problem to deal with, which ended up on my lap. The problem is Labour supporters around the country support Labour because they want to see a political change, they want to see social justice. People in my constituency on housing benefit, universal credit are hard up. Most of them voted Remain. People in Easington, in the northeast, on housing benefit, in exactly the same situation, probably voted Leave. Their unity ought to be about progress towards social justice.
Yeah.
So I tried to bring people together on this.
And that bothered me, I remember, because I was in a Leave seat.
Yeah.
And the narrative was, well, everyone who voted Leave was a bunch of racists, right?
Which they're not.
Yeah. But we weren't allowed to say that because the liberal media would hammer you if you said, no, well, they had genuine economic angst and maybe they chose the wrong area to put it in, but
it
was
genuine.
They had
economic angst. And I remember I was in Cornwall campaigning for a yes vote in the referendum, the Remain and Reform agenda that we put forward. I remember having a discussion with people in Cornwall. Now, Cornwall had a lot of Objective One money from the EU, but is a poor county. No question about that. Wages are very low. Jobs are very insecure. And the whole place gets swamped and by property developers buying up second homes and leaving them empty most of the time. So it's there's a lot of unhappiness in Cornwall. And I remember talking to a bunch of people in Truro and other places, and they were all going to vote Leave. And I said, why? He said, there's nothing in it for us. And I got the same in other places. I felt that, in a sense, it was a vote, yes, for a different way of doing things, but it was a vote of anger against communities that had been left behind.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, I think Keir spearheaded the second referendum vote. And I remember this conference speech where he said, you know, Remain would very much be on the table. And I think, I'll be honest with you, I think that was the moment we lost the election in 2019. Because even when I was door knocking, there's nothing that I could say that broke through that Brexit barrier.
We obviously tried to run the election campaign on health, social justice, and all the other issues.
I mean, I laid down in front of a bulldozer to try and get people, but it was just
my
Brexit.
My constituency voted 80% Remain in the referendum.
Yeah.
They were concerned. Yeah. Nobody was happy. Did we make the right call? We made the call that seemed to me a way of bringing the party together. And I have to say, on the eve of the 2019 conference, there was a meeting of TULO, Trade Unions and Labour Organization. All the unions were there that are affiliated to the party, some of whom had been Remain, some of whom had been Leave. Unanimous support for that decision.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, last question on Keir, I promise, because I want to get to the book now. It's looking likely that he might be the next Prime Minister. You worked with him, at least. I mean, you didn't have a particular personal relationship, but you worked with him. If an alien was to come to Earth and you had to describe Keir in one or two words to them, what words would you use?
I would say he's somebody that is very determined to hold on to his position, exercises power in a very personal and quite ruthless way at times, and sees what he believes the right form of winning an election to be an end in itself rather than a means to mm-hmm. an end. And I get concerned about that, and concerned about the undermining of democracy in the party and some of the rule changes that he's pushed through. One, for example, which was astonishing, which says the rules of natural justice do not apply to the Labour Party rule book.
Yeah, I mean, I've been on the receiving end of some of those rule changes.
You've been on the receiving end of a lack of natural justice.
Yeah. I want to get to the book.
And natural justice on me has been rather limited as well.
Yeah, so I want to get to the book because that's the reason we're here. Yep. So you've written a book or you've put together a book with Len McCluskey, Poetry for the Many. Tell us a little bit about how this came together.
Well, Len and I were having a chat in my office one time about economic strategy. We get on very well, so we had a long chat. There wasn't really much debate. We were fundamentally in agreement. Then Len sort of stretches back like this, looks around and sees my bookcase. He said, "Wait, why have you got all these poetry books in your bookcase?" I said, "Well, I like poetry." He said, "I haven't got that one. Can I borrow it?"
Yeah.
"Sure, be my guest." And so Len often quotes particularly Emily Dickinson, and he was very interested as to why I quoted from Ben Okri in my conference speech in 2015, just after I'd been elected. And I said, "Well, I think there's a poet in all of us, and poetry inspires and excites, and too many young people continue writing poetry after leaving primary school but are embarrassed to say so."
Yeah.
And so we then talked about this quite a lot, and then I said, "Look, why don't we try with Melissa Benn, because she's ideal for this, to do a poetry evening in Liverpool at the Casa." I said, "Okay." So we had an evening at the Casa. We booked it. The Casa's a club in Hope Street in Liverpool. Absolutely packed out to the rafters. We could hardly get in ourselves.
Right.
When I thought this thing was going to be a bit of a...
Well, you would think so with poetry. Because as you write in your introduction, I think what's interesting about the book, in your introduction, you write about how sometimes poetry is kind of looked down upon, or people are embarrassed, and there are poets in all of us, but people are embarrassed to bring it out.
Yeah, well, that's right. There's a poet in everybody. So we did the event in the Casa. That was really good. Then Colin Robinson from All Books was there, who's an old friend, and he's from Liverpool as well, although he lives in New York now, and he was there because he was seeing his dad. And he said, "That was really nice. I enjoyed that. Would you two like to put it into a book?" "What?" I said, "Well, I'll think about it." So we thought about it and then agreed we would try it, and we would choose poems each, write as to what they meant to us, and then invite other people such as Morag Livingstone, Ken Loach, I've got them here, Gary Young, Maxine Peake, Michael Rosen, and so on, each to choose a poem and say why they loved it. Mm. And so it took longer than I thought it would to put together, and much harder to do than I expected, because it's very hard leaving poems out.
Yeah, and it's a labour of love, right?
Because it's a labour of love. Yeah. And so what I did was I booked quite a lot of evening time and weekend time, and then my desk just became like a poetry library.
Right, yeah.
And I kept phoning people up and saying, "Have you got the complete works of Brecht?" "What? Yeah, yeah, I think we have somewhere." Yeah. So I borrow all these books.
So how many poems did you go through? How many are in there in the end?
And there's 20 each.
Did you go through to get to the 20?
Oh, hundreds.
Hundreds.
I read an awful lot of poetry. I read a lot of poetry anyway, so it was a joy.
So
it was a love and a joy doing it.
It's funny that we talk about this because, so as you know, I come from an Iranian background.
Yeah.
And poetry is a big part of our culture.
Absolutely.
And I grew up with poetry to the point of frustration. My dad, whenever he wanted to tell me off, wouldn't shout, wouldn't tell me off. He'd read poetry to me as a sort of lesson to learn. And one of the big ones he used to say, "The translation's awful. It doesn't translate."
Do me a favor, for the next poetry book, will you give us some advice on an Iranian poet?
First of all,
that your dad read to you.
So my dad read my granddad's poetry. My granddad was a poet himself, published poet in Iran. And he had this poem that he always used to say to me. He's passed away now, both my dad and my granddad. But the translation doesn't work, but essentially it would be something like, "Every day you go to shower and you cleanse your body, one day I wish you'd go to shower and cleanse your soul. And he always used to say this to me, right? As a way of teaching. Whenever I did something bad, he'd say, go into the shower. Don't just cleanse your body, cleanse your soul and come back out. So I know how important poetry can be.
And how powerful.
And how powerful it can be. And I often say in politics, politics is poetry. It's not prose. Yes. And I think nothing encapsulates that better than For the Many, Not the Few. Because,
poetry,
of course, where does that come from?
What inspires people. And my whole political message is not about the details of economics, the details of this, details mm-hmm. that. It's the spirit that moves people. Mm-hmm. And political change does not come from what MPs say to each other in the tea room. Political change comes because of the activity of people in our communities.
But it's also so powerful in terms of a communication message.
Me
and the producers were sat in the sort of green room before you came in, and I was saying one of the best lessons that I've learned in politics is that the way to get people to join you in your movement, in your ideas, it's not what you say, it's how you make them feel. And that's the power that I think For the Many, Not the Few as a slogan had, which of course comes from poetry. And that's the power that poetry
has. It's inspired by Shelley.
Yeah.
That's where it came from.
Yeah.
We spent ages trying to think up something for the 2017 election manifesto.
Yeah. How did you come to it?
Well, we're having a discussion in the office and people come up with various things. I said, none of that. None of that's going to work. I said, you've got to understand what this is about.
Yeah.
This is about people. It's about mobilizing people. It's about giving people hope. It's not about sort of offering an a la carte menu of what's going on. It's about hope, and it's about the holistic approach, and it's about art and everything else. And that's why every one of our rallies had music and so on and so on. Mm. And they said, yeah, so what's your favorite poem? I said, well, that's hard, but I suppose you've got to say Shelley. They said, oh, yeah, that bit about many. I said, you got it.
That's the one. That's the one. Right. We're running out of time, so I do want to ask you something.
Yep.
This is the questionnaire that we ask all of our guests, and I'm going to get you to read your poem at the end of the thing, if that's okay. But we ask all of our guests a list of questionnaires. It's from a French series by Bernard Pivot called Boline de Culture, and it's a questionnaire that I love because I think it gives us an insight into the person's mind. And I've asked John this. I've asked Michael Crick, was a journalist who was here. I've asked him. So,
God, he could be irritating, but he's very interesting.
You know, on the question of Labour Party democracy, he would never claim to be on the left of the party. He said it here. He said, I actually identify with the right of the party, but the democratic sort of deficit in the party right now is horrible. Anyway, on this. So, question on Bernard Pivot. First things that come to your mind. What is your favourite word?
No. When people are trying to ask me to do something, I refuse to do.
You can say no. Have you found it hard to say no in your life?
Sometimes.
Yeah. What is your least favourite word?
Local government language describing deficits.
You know what? You said local government. I had flashback to bins. Christ, the amount of emails I got about bins. So what turns you on creatively, spiritually, or emotionally? What's something that gets your juices going in terms of creativity?
Nature, beauty, and imaginative art and poetry.
And what turns you off?
Boring mainstream music.
Oh, right. Anyone you want to name?
No. Most of Radio 2.
Yeah. I'm often told that I have the music taste of an 80-year-old, so I'm not a big fan of modern music either. So John refused to answer this question, and you can also refuse to answer. What's your favorite curse word or swear word, if you have one? We're allowed to swear on that. You can miss this one
out.
Oh,
damn you.
What sound or noise...
It's quite low-key.
What sound or noise do you hate?
Screech of metal on metal. Like that.
What sound or noise do you love?
Birdsong.
Birdsong, right. Yeah. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt? So if you weren't a politician, what would you like to do?
Probably a farmer.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I know you once gave me some jam. I don't know if you remember, as a candidate, you gave me some jam.
I do.
And my mum particularly loved it. What profession?
Does she want more? Is that a request for more?
if there's going, I'll drive to North London. What profession would you never like to do? So, what's the worst profession you can think of? Not that there's anything wrong with it, but you can't see yourself doing it.
I think I'd be the world's worst banker because I'd be far too generous with the poor customers.
And then, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
welcome, but can you explain what you've been doing?
Right. So I do want to end it. We've been talking about the poetry book, and it's such an important part of why you're here and what you're doing. And you've written a very important... I read this two nights ago. You've written a really interesting poem about Calais. Yeah. You can either read that or one of your other favorites.
I'd love to. Just to say, the book is dedicated to Julian Assange.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Freedom. And how can people get it? They can get it everywhere, right?
You get it everywhere. Yeah. Buy it directly from all books, buy it online, or access Peace and Justice Project website, thecorbynproject.com, and that will direct you to how to buy it. I chose lots of poems, all of which were beautiful in their own way, some of which are very challenging. Very nice one from Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz, a Mexican woman who was... died very young. She was in colonial Mexico, and the Catholic Church hated her because she could read and write, and she wrote up for women's rights, so she was imprisoned. And she died, and then the church destroyed nearly all of her papers, but Octavio Paz and others have managed to recover some. Mm-hmm. So we put her poem in You Foolish Men.
Oh, nice.
And it was written 100 years before Mary Wollstonecraft came along.
Oh, wow.
Snippet. I feel very, very angry about the way we treat refugees, asylum seekers. Uh-huh. I've been to Calais a number of times. And when I came back from one visit to Calais, I wrote a poem. I won't read it all because there isn't enough time. I'll just read the first three verses, if I may. Cold, wet marshlands surround Calais in winter. The poem is called Calais in Winter. So I'll start again. Cold, wet marshlands surround Calais in winter. Police take tents away from the homeless. The railway station is protected with razor wire. Motorways have walls on each side. Trees are cut down to create open land. Huge rocks prevent anyone leaving a road. There is fear in Calais. It stalks every official building. It seeps into the minds of the police. It pervades all thinking. It gives imagination to cold-hearted people to confront the enemy. When they escape to the sea in flimsy boats that would be at home in a small lake, they have to be stopped, with bayonets puncturing them, clothing taken that would protect against the cold. The enemy comes on foot, in lorries and buses, with few clothes, no money and no food, few friends, only memories of bombardment and war, of families in jail, of crops destroyed, of empty schools, of floods and drought, of bitter travelling, in secret lorries, on mountain paths, in safe houses, of razor wires and cameras hidden in trees.
Jeremy Corbyn, MP for Islington North, poet now, and former leader of the Labour Party. I think you began your leadership by going to a refugee Refugees Are Welcome event, and I can't think of anything more apt to end the interview with you reading your wonderful poem about refugees in Calais. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for joining us.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Jeremy Corbyn speaking to me back in November. Back in June, however, former Prime Minister and my political rival Boris Johnson stood down as MP, LOL. I spoke to the former Deputy Prime Minister, Lord Heseltine, who did not hold back his opinions and his criticism of Boris Johnson. Really interesting. Give this a listen. Lord Heseltine, thank you so much for joining us. What do you make of this bombshell finding from the Privileges Committee?
Well, it's not really much of a surprise, is it? Because it's been extensively leaked over the last 3 days and dramatically escalated by Boris Johnson's decision to forestall the findings by leaving Parliament. And I think all of us who watch these events with a certain curiosity, shall we say, politely, realized that he conducted a brilliant coup de théâtre. He was under deep apprehension as to what the report was going to say. It's probably worse than his worst fears. And rather than stay and take the flak, he not only attacked the committee in a wholly reprehensible way, but got out so that any penalty they could recommend was irrelevant. The point I made about his attack on the committee was a pack of lies. I mean, this committee is a select committee of the House of Commons with a Conservative majority, with the ability to recommend to Parliament anything that it feels appropriate. It's to Parliament who makes the decision, but Boris Johnson was not prepared to allow Parliament to have that opportunity. And so he got out from under. But the serious issue, of course, is that he lied to Parliament. And I'm afraid this is a much bigger issue than the result of the COVID inquiry, which is all wrapped up in the Select Committee report, because the really disastrous issue of our time is Brexit. And that, again, was masterminded by Boris Johnson, who told a pack of lies.
Yes, and I guess this is one of the things we've been talking about, as well as the findings of the Privileges Committee. Boris Johnson's relationship with the truth and his propensity for impropriety and lies in public office. I wonder what you think that has had, what kind of impact that's had on our politics and the strength of our political institutions.
Well, I think it has done the Brexit decision, which is, as I've said, it was based on a pack of lies, has done great harm to our economy. It has done great harm to our international reputation as a sane, practical, well-run country. And it has done unforgivable damage to the aspirations of a younger generation who've seen themselves cut off from the center of power of the world power grouping of Europe, of which we are a fundamental part.
And so do you think that this is the case where whoever the next prime minister is, as well as Rishi and the future of foreign affairs, but also institutions here at home, is there a rebuilding job to be done after Boris? Because he has really wrecked our reputation around the world and with voters here at home.
Well, I think we must be fair to the present prime minister. He has brought sanity back to the conduct of our affairs. But he is a prisoner of the Brexit movement within the Conservative Party. And it seems evident to me that all the other political leaders are in the same sort of bind, that they are frightened of the effect that Brexit has had, particularly in what are known as the bedwall seats north of Birmingham, who've been told that the fault of Britain's demise is all about immigrants and Brussels and the forms that people have to fill in and all these things. And to turn around and try and tell people that that is, quite frankly, a gross misrepresentation of the truth is a huge reversal of political strategy. And the leaders of our parties are running away from it. But they will have to embrace it, particularly as the younger generation are frustrated by where we are and know perfectly well that any sane government would be seeking to restore our relationship with Europe.
Yes, and you spoke about, you know, Rishi Sunak's attempt to kind of distance himself from Boris and change the perception. The reality is, even now, there are many in the Conservative Party who continue to defend Boris. And much like Donald Trump in America, although sometimes I find the links difficult to make, but much like Donald Trump, it seems the Conservative Party has changed, given that it's not just Boris Johnson, he has now left the scene, but people like Nadine Dorris, Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, there are a lot of members of Parliament, prominent members of the Conservative Party, that are within that sort of Boris realm. And so is there difficulty in being able to recover this, given that he, you know, some of his acolytes continue to exist within the Conservative Party? And, you know, you are a veteran of the Conservative Party. Is this party recognisable to the one that you served under?
That is a very difficult question for people like me. I think the headline answer is no, because I worked for the Conservative Party since the days of Winston Churchill and on through Eric Douglas Hume and Ted Heath, of course, Harold Macmillan as well, and Margaret Thatcher and John Major, and indeed through to the time I spent working for David Cameron. And there is no comparison between the sort of sanity of those prime ministers and their pursuit of national self-interest and the lunacy of the greatest political mistake of the last half century. I mean, to believe that you can prosper by cutting off your biggest marketplace. How can any sane person believe that? Unless they were told that there were all sorts of opportunities in the rest of the world, which patently there aren't. And every day that goes by, and let's be frank, it's now 7 years since the Brexiteers became the principal force in government, not on the backbenches, not in the newspapers, in government. They've been there for 7 years, and they've failed to give any substance to the promises on which they got elected.
Yeah, and I think, look, even Nigel Farage, who was the bastion of Brexit, certainly before the referendum and during, has admitted on TV that Brexit hasn't worked. If you were advising Rishi Sunak, which I don't know you may be doing, what would your advice be to him to do next?
Well, first I would say to him, don't get into the punch-up with Boris Johnson. A, you won't win, because he will sling ever larger lumps of mud. And unfortunately, there are newspapers only too happy to carry in their headlines this sort of low-level political abuse. And I'm afraid the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph are now still giving Boris Johnson airtime and fanning the flames. And as long as they keep doing that, Boris Johnson will keep providing the wherewithal for their headlines. So what I think Rishi Sunak has to do, which he started doing, is governing sanely, truthfully, and explaining to people just how difficult and lonely the British position is. Now, he has this huge problem that the Brexit element of the Conservative Party don't like that and will make very noisy interruptions at every stage, damaging to the party and to our electoral prospects. Rishi Sunak has to show the leadership and the dignity to rise above this level of internecine warfare and to show that he's trying to tackle the real problems in ways which will, in the end, command respect.
Okay, and last question to you. I'm really appreciative of your time. Our last question would be, do you think, given everything that has happened around Boris Johnson, the failure of Liz Truss's premiership, do you think the Conservative Party has a chance of winning the next general election?
Well, nobody is going to look at the present opinion polls and the local authority results and give you a simple yes answer to that question. It is difficult to see what the outcome of the next general election is. I don't believe that the evidence is there to show that there's going to be an overall Labour majority. There may be, but at the moment, I don't think there's evidence that would frighten me if I was advising anyone on the subject. I think it's containable, but equally, it will require, and this is in the light of the very difficult economic circumstances we're facing, with rising interest rates and inflation at unacceptable levels, it is very difficult to see how the Conservatives pull back to a position of power after the election.
Do you think Rishi Sunak can lead them to a victory?
I believe that in the end they will recover their prime position in British democracy. But they're in a very difficult position at the moment.
Just quick follow-up. Do you think Rishi Sunak can be a viable candidate for Prime Minister on a ballot paper for the Conservative Party? Do you think he'll be an asset or perhaps a weakness?
I have no doubt that he is an asset to the Conservative Party. And as I keep repeating, he has brought sanity back to the conduct of our affairs. You feel he is a man of integrity. You may not agree with everything that he says. I don't agree with his Brexit views. But I can see a hard-working man who understands the scale of the problems and is devoting himself with energy to find coherent solutions. And against the background where he is telling people a very substantial part of the truth about our position.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Lord Heseltine, former Deputy Prime Minister under John Mayer, a Conservative peer and a veteran of the Conservative Party. Lord Heseltine, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Lord Heseltine there. And that concludes our show. And we look back and our look back on our favourite interviews from 2023. I'll be back next week to analyse the biggest political stories of the week. So join me then. We're going to be getting into an exciting year, 2024, full of guests, controversies, politics. So do join me. I'll see you next week. Salams.